Hello. Ah, now that I've got your attention, I'd like a quick word about how Cambridge 105 Radio is funded. Our job is to give a voice to those groups who may not otherwise be heard. That may be our support for local music or the charity of the month. You're wanting to know how you can help, aren't you? Well, you can support our advertisers. And when you use their services, say you heard about them on Cambridge 105 Radio. And you can make a donation. It all goes towards our upkeep. We're eco-friendly, but we do have a bit of an electricity bill. Visit cambridge105.co.uk and click on the donate button. And thank you for listening.
Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 Radio.
All right, here we go. Quiet!
Quiet!
Problem!
You want the moon? Just say the word and I'll throw a lasso around it, pull it down.
Mr. Allen, this may come as a shock to you, but there are some men who don't end every sentence with a proposition.
All right, I'll jump first.
Nope. Then you jump first.
No, I said.
What's the matter with you?
I can't swim!
I don't like that music anymore. Mind if I close the window?
Every one of you listening to my voice, tell the world, watch the skies everywhere. Keep looking. Keep watching the skies.
Well, here's another nice mess you've gotten me into.
Hello, you are listening to Cambridge 105 Radio across the city and South Cambridgeshire, and this is Bums on Seats, the show that only has eyes for cinema. I'm Toby Miller, and with me in the studio today are Emma Marchant.
Hello there.
Ashley Capaldi.
Hello.
And Mark Baylor.
Hello.
But today's programme is going to rush from the Fourth Estate to an American Lilliput via the Land of the Dead. Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep team up to help bring the US government to account in The Post, while Pixar's Coco is a genealogical Mexican roller coaster, and Matt Damon shrinks himself down to size in the satire of downsizing. Alongside those reviews, we've also an interview with Merlin Crossingham, animation director on Early Man, Aardman's new animated feature, and we'll be speaking to Jackie Sutton-Adam about February's Films for Our Future, which is part of Transition Cambridge. So, lots to come, but we start to fight for the First Amendment.
This is a devastating security breach that was leaked out of the Pentagon.
The most highly classified documents of the war.
The Times has 7,000 pages detailing how the White House has been lying about the Vietnam War for 30 years.
You're talking about exposing years of government secrets.
Is that legal?
What is it you think we do here for a living, kid?
Ben, I might have something.
It must be precious cargo.
It's just government secrets.
The New York Times was barred from publishing any more classified documents dealing with the Vietnam War.
If the government wins, the Washington Post will cease to exist.
If we don't hold them accountable, who will?
We can't hold them accountable if we don't have a newspaper.
Nixon will muster the full power of the presidency, and if there's a way to destroy you, by God, he'll find it.
What are you going to do, Mrs. Graham?
Over the past year, it's become de rigueur to examine movies for any comment on current American politics. There is certainly a connection with The Post. Steven Spielberg has made no secret that his new film is an urgent response to the Trump administration's on the attacks on the freedom of the press. The Post looks in detail at the 1971 leaking of the Pentagon Papers, a highly classified Department of Defense report that revealed how successive presidents had lied about the war in Vietnam. When the New York Times publishes an excerpt of the stolen report, the Nixon White House responds with an injunction. Then the Washington Post, which is a much smaller paper at this time, isn't even the first paper in Washington, it plans to go public with its own copy of the papers, a decision which causes friction between the Post's editor, Bren Bradley, played by Tom Hanks, and the paper's owner, Catherine Graham, played by Meryl Streep. Mark, you work at a newspaper, so was The Post an invigorating shot of the arm? Did you run into work on Monday and scream, we must start telling the truth? Or is it sending calls to Newcastle for you?
Well, first of all, I don't actually work at a newspaper anymore. So I'm now an ex-journalist, but only recently, fairly recently so. So, it made me think about, you know, what it was like to be on a newspaper and the excitement that the journalists have right across the board from the editor all the way down when you know, they get the story and their pursuit of the story, and then obviously the dilemma is whether to publish or not. I could sort of relate to the excitement, not obviously not having had a story quite as big as that, but the excitement of the journalist really comes through, and the excitement of the story and the importance of it is something that comes through throughout. And I'd like to think that anyone would be able to kind of get that, whether they've got any connections with newspapers or not. I think that came through really, really strongly. And the importance of the story as well came through, I thought, pretty well, even though, I mean, I studied the Vietnam War, so I have sort of two levels of interest in the film, I guess. But I think the key points, everything that the film sort of is really about, kind of comes across quite well. They drip feed the facts in, and even if you don't know anything about the Vietnam War, you know enough from this film to see how important the story was and its significance.
Emma, Spielberg wrote, he swings back and forth from his entertainment, a bit like Graham Greene did, his entertainments and his serious novels. This is a serious novel, a serious film, but it's more in the style of his entertainments. It's not overly long, and it's, he's trying to make it thrilling. He's trying to tell a rollicking good yarn in a way. There's an important underlying message, but his, you know, is it almost a B movie in terms of its scope? Does he succeed? Does it make it into a thrilling? It's not history.
No, I think he did succeed. I think the camera is incredibly active in this film. The camera is moving around the whole time. It has got the benefit, I always think, of like 1970s journalism films. Everyone's smoking, everyone's drinking.
Everybody wears hats still.
Exactly. Well, yeah, this is it. And you kind of look at it and you think, oh, that's because, well, you know, when like in 1979 or whatever, when I was six, I wanted to be a journalist. I thought it would just be that, marching around rooms and, you know, scrawling away. But there are, so it has that sort of, sorry, if I spit it out, Emma. It has that on its side, that it's quite easy to make this kind of gripping. But I think he did a really good job. It's muscular. I love the scenes. We were talking about this. I love the scenes with the printing press itself. I thought they were really...
He loves that technology in the way he used to love UFOs.
It was almost like a love letter to that.
I mean, that's exactly what I was going to say. I was thinking it when I was watching.
It's like
it.
A love letter to
it's
old
a love
school.
Letter to newspapers and traditional journalism.
And, you know, and with a cut, again, and we were talking before we went on air, you know, this was... you were saying to everything from script to finish, it was 9 months. It was shot and edited in 6 months. So it was a very, you know, he's chosen to make this film in this time because obviously it is a parallel story to the current times that America are living through, like you said. But it's just a fabulous cast, stuffed full of brilliant TV and movie character actors. You know, Jesse Plemons, Bob Odenkirk, Bradley Whitford, all of these guys pop in and don't necessarily have huge parts. But it's still, it's probably Meryl Streep's film, though, I would say.
Ashley, we've concentrated on the as Emma just said, the sort of parallel politics between this and what's currently going on in America with the current administration and the First Amendment. But this is also, as Spielberg's pointed out, and it's worthwhile that pointing out the scriptwriter on this is female, that Liz Hanna, in that it's Meryl Streep's film, in that it's a story about a woman trying to find a place in the workplace that she didn't want. Catherine Graham didn't want this job. She was handed this job through her husband's suicide. So it takes, even though she's a middle-aged lady, she still has to find her feet in this male-only environment. Spielberg does his sort of heavy-handed approach to that, but does that still getting across not an important message, but it still seems to seem things we see rarely in cinema.
Heavy-handed is a good way to put it, because it was all very obvious to me, the comments that are made to her by her other middle-aged female friends, like, oh, I don't know how you managed to put this dinner party on, what with your day job you have to be.
But that might have been true of the time.
exactly, and it was just very, very bluntly delivered. But yeah, it was her film, but again, her big shining moment when she has to explain to this, it looked like a board of directors to me, yes, but this isn't his company anymore, this is my company, I'm choosing to do this. And I think it worked in the real life character's favour, in that she was having to work against Tom Hanks' character in a way, but I really liked how the two of them worked together. So I got the feeling that Tom Hanks' character knew that his newspaper couldn't do this, but he wants this story out. It's a real integrity of
classic. Well, he's going to bully Ben Bradley. He's painted as bullying her. He's not as awful as the men she has in the boardroom meeting at the beginning that Catherine Graham has to go against, but he does bully her slightly at the breakfast meeting and gradually comes onto her side.
I liked their relationship, though. I felt he was chivying her along. He knew what he was doing. It was for the good of the story, and he would have done it if she was a bloke. joke, I think.
I'm not sure. I think, because I think there's that scene which plays on many levels where she says, where he accuses Catherine Graham of you're going soft on Robert McNamara because he's a family friend, and she goes and she says, well, you were a friend of the Kennedys.
But to get at
I think the way that scene's played is that he's surprised she comes back at him.
But it
he's
was
not
in,
used to that that fairness of fight. Sorry, Emma.
It was interesting to me, I was going to say that actually, it's a really key moment as well. It's a very... Steven Spielberg, the scriptwriter, gives Sarah Paulson, who's playing Ben Bradley's wife, the artist, and they give her this really key speech. And it's only when she says that to Tom Hanks, and, you know, basically it's a whole kind of like, you have no idea how hard it's been for, you know, Kegger. And it is, like you said, that's maybe his heavy-handedness.
That's the scene for the audience.
But it's delivered beautifully. Yeah. But it's interesting that, you know, like I say, yes, he might have bullied her, but of course it's only through the eyes of his wife that he then realises that...
And, what a fool I've been. What a sexist dinosaur I've been up to this
moment.
Yeah,
and I'm not saying if that's good or bad. Like I say, it's beautifully delivered by Sarah Paulson.
Yeah, I would say that I found the relationship between Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep's character, I found that totally believable. I have to say, having sat in newsrooms where, obviously, again, much lower down the scale, but these kind of dilemmas have come up in regards to various legal issues and so on, and that is very believable. I've seen numerous editors push back against their bosses and so on in these kind of situations, and that, to me, played out in a very believable manner. I can definitely believe that, regardless of gender issues or anything like that.
That was a great, more than the gender issues, I got the nice Wild West feeling of the old printing press. Yeah. Kind of, we have this tiny little legal loophole and we're going to go for it and you can't stop us. And that's the only thing that I thought really played for them was the time limit they had. So they know some new injunction type thing's coming in 9 hours. So they need to read through all these documents and get something printed. And that was the exciting thing for me. And it was this room of people in the Wild West of printing government secrets.
There's also enough. I saw the film twice because I had some time to kill, so I saw it again yesterday, which is unusual for me, but I wanted to see those camera moves that he pulled. There's some very rough camera moves. It's not all, doesn't all look like Max Ophuls. There's some obvious stuff they had to speed through. But I like the fact that Tom Hanks' character, and you get a sense of the cynicism. That yes, they're fighting for the First Amendment, and there are scenes that play up on that and sort of yellow highlight it. But there's also the sense they also lean on the other papers when they don't get the wedding story at the beginning, Nixon's daughter's wedding. And you get the sense that, yes, we're fighting for the First Amendment, but we're also fighting to exist in a very crowded market, and we need this above-the-fold headline.
I felt as well it was an interesting transition. Meryl Streep, there was definitely, and again, it wasn't the most subtle, but there was a definite move from Meryl Streep at the beginning where she kind of turned up all sort of chaotic and dropping her papers and her glasses and all the rest for that first meeting.
It's a very pantomime moment.
Yeah, and then as the film goes on, you see her kind of grow in her own mind and her own stature.
That whole scene where there's two big scenes with her, one where the phone scene when everybody's on different on phones stretched across Washington and having this long big party call thing.
Yeah.
But there's another scene where she's surrounded by men and she's in her nightdress. And I thought that was beautifully played because they've dressed her I don't know if that's true to the time, whether this discussion really happened in the dead of night, just because obviously the prince are ready to roll, but just making her that defenseless. And then that's the moment where she finally just really sparks.
Yeah.
Because she doesn't have the distancing effect of everybody being on a phone. She has to face the men down there. I thought that was much better than the pantomime scene at the beginning where she's the very Meryl Streepish and slightly going over the top, but also being
playing on her Thatcher character a little too much. I think she was rehashing quite a lot of what she conjured up for that, and it reminded me too much of it. I'm like, you haven't created someone totally new for this.
There's a few too familiar ticks sometimes.
The hairdo
with
mainly.
is there the fine? This is, I don't know how vital a film like this is because it depends on who sees it, and this. The Trump's base see it and have an epiphany, it matters not one jot. But does it feel like, because if Spielberg's action films, if Jurassic Park is the roller coaster ride, I wondered if this is sort of, to keep on the theme park analogy, this is one of those slow boat rides where you go around the Hall of Presidents and it constantly stops at little moments and it says here, and Morgan Freeman intones this moment in history, this happened. Did it feel like that to anybody? I like Spielberg, but it still felt like this was history for a multiplex audience.
No, it just felt more to me like a newspaper film. Like I said, that was the... I got more of... I got more of that in terms of the way it was made. Because like you said, it is a pretty brisk running time. I think it's like 115 minutes or something. So it's snappy. And I think, obviously, there was a lot of chat before, you know, this is Hanks, Streep, Spielberg together for the first time. And I felt that they didn't indulge that.
No, everybody gets a fair shot.
Yeah. And like I said, surrounded with such a strong supporting cast as well. So, yeah, it probably is. But I think I'm sure I've said this in this very position before. Is there anything wrong with saying history for multiplex audiences?
No, there isn't.
Particularly from such a populist director as
Steven Spielberg. There isn't, unless it's the only thing being made. Which I think that's the only danger, but that's not Spielberg's fault.
I think Spotlight did this better.
I was going to say, I thought it was. I like both films just for sort of slightly different reasons. I thought Spotlight was perhaps a little more level in terms of its dramatic scenes, and it was very much a bit more low key than this was, I would say. But tonally, and in terms of that, to me, Spotlight was kind of like the story was the investigation, and again, the newspaper. I thought this, in the same way, it's kind of like a newspaper film.
You can feel they took more care with Spotlight. So I wasn't quite aware of how speedily this was pulled together, and now it's been mentioned to me that it really shows through. Spotlight was a very slow.
Also, Spotlight covers
project,
an investigation that went over many months and years. Yeah. This was 8 days.
That was much
days,
more emotional. Yeah. It's a much more emotional. Mm. You know, this isn't particularly emotional to the people. I mean, obviously, there is the comments that, you know, there's a woman, a young girl at the end, who sort of says to Meryl Streep, "My brother's back now from Vietnam, but I'm so pleased you're doing what you're doing." And obviously, but they don't play on that too much. You know, you have the very first scene. I like how it opened in Vietnam, though. I really enjoyed the beginning of it. And then when you realise how long it would have taken to have copied those. That's a brilliant opening scene with Matthew Rhys playing the original guy who photographed, you know, and you realise
it's literally as much as he can carry without being detected in his satchel.
Exactly.
That's all he could do.
And he just had to go back and forth. Yeah. I don't know how many months it took them to photocopy the whole lot, but that was brilliant. And then there's a great reveal where Bob Odenkirk walks into the motel room and it's just they're there.
They're stretched all over the bed. It makes no sense, but it's a typical Spielberg emotional visual. It's the mothership behind the
it's
Devil's Tower is this.
Three double beds worth of paperwork.
Yes,
that was it.
Yes, which then almost fits all into just two boxes. Though he does say this isn't all the papers, this is 4,000 pages or something. Okay, all right, well, The Post opened last Friday and is still showing at both multiplex cinemas in Cambridge. It's a bit like Bridge of Spies. I imagine this will run and run and run, probably the same audience. It's at the Arts Picture House, it's Light, and it is at The View, and it is a Certificate 13. Transition Cambridge is something you might have come across in Cambridge. It's a rolling series of events that aims to help Cambridge make the transition to ways of life that are more resilient in the face of rising energy prices and a changing climate. And this February, Transition Cambridge is running a short but busy film festival. Running from February the 4th to the 17th, Films for Our Future is a selection of inspirational films and discussions hosted by sustainability and environmental groups from Cambridge and nearby villages. 9 films are showing across 9 nights in a variety of venues. The subjects range from digital arts and food waste to veganism, consumerism and climate change. In a moment, we'll have Jackie Sutton Adam in the studio to run through some of the films, but first let's hear a little bit from the documentary Beauty and the Bike, which is about the reluctance among teenagers to keep cycling.
My friends don't go out with bikes, so I just thought I'd chuck it away. I
cycled quite a lot when I was little, but I don't really use bikes regularly, like going to school or to see friends. I either walk or get a lift off my parents, which is a bad habit really.
Yeah, it's just me on my own, but there's 2 other girls in the school who cycle in year 7, so they've just come up.
It's not seen as anything stylish, so it doesn't appeal to girls.
What would make you interested in cycling?
If I see someone very like fashionable at the same time but using a bike, because you know I've never seen like someone wearing high heels and then using a bike, because they normally wear flat shoes and stuff like that.
Jackie, thank you for joining us in the studio. We'll start at the very beginning. Am I right? It's 9 films for our future. Is 9 films across 9 nights?
I haven't actually counted them, but it's about that. Yes, it's been a bit of a whirlwind of pulling everything together, talking with various sustainability groups, getting them on board, tweaking things that you know we were trying to do. So actually, I have yet to count the number of films that we've got on offer. It's quite a few, though.
Is this the first year you've run this?
This is the first time we've done something on this scale. We have shown films before, one-offs occasionally, as part of our programme within Transition Cambridge, of interesting things to help educate and inform people or rather let them find out for themselves what kind of things we all could be doing to make a better, fairer future for the whole planet.
You sort of answer this question there, but are these the films you have screening? We'll go into those in a moment, but are you preaching to the converted, or are you, it's the curious that you hope are coming to these screenings?
We absolutely do, Toby, yes. There's always a danger, particularly with small groups like us. We haven't got a huge budget for publicity, so it's true. A lot of the time, the people we see are the usual suspects, let's call them. Lovely people, but yes, you're right, the converted. With this festival, we're really hoping and aiming for people who perhaps are aware of some part or a bit of the problem, maybe feeling a bit like unsure about what their next steps could be, how they might get involved to do something. So the films, really, the film season is really a chance for people to inform themselves through the films, and we're going to use those films as a sort of conversational hook to have discussions and conversations after all the films to help people find their way, to find their next step in the process for themselves.
That said, is it important where you're screening the films? Because we deal with a lot of mini film festivals on the show, and they all tend to be university based or in university premises, like St. John's or somewhere like that. You're very much not that. You are in a remark, which is a good thing. It's nothing but praise. But I wanted, because the venues that you're in, especially the villages that you're in Haslingfield, yes, and places like that. Again part of?
So it was about a year ago when we had the first kind of discussion where the idea of a festival came about. And I think the idea of inviting out of town environmental groups was twofold. We were aware that there was a lot going on, but actually none of these groups are really very well connected. We're so busy doing our thing, it's very hard to find extra time to link up and find, to do things collaboratively. And we just thought, why not make it easy on ourselves by asking people to collaborate, asking different groups to collaborate. So can you, environmental group in a village, would you like to put on a film about sustainability and making a better future as part of this festival? And we were absolutely overwhelmed with the response from organising groups, many of whom who were too short of manpower, woman power really, to be able to put on the film. But if this thing takes off, and I'm really hoping it will, this may form the seed of something that is ongoing, either as a sort of like regular feature, a film a month maybe, or perhaps next year we do a festival which is a little bit more high profile. And the venues that we've chosen, really, I had very little to do with it. It's like, what's happening? Have you got a film idea? Great. Can you find a venue? Yes. Fantastic. You're on. That's how simple it was.
It's we'll speak a little bit about the films, and I stupidly left my note somewhere else, which had everything circled. There it is. Thank you very much. Trying to get onto the internet. You've got a couple of big documentaries to sort of end up with before the flood and The Age of Stupid, which we've dealt with on the show before, reviewed on the show in the past. So I'll focus on some of the smaller things. Well, we'll just start with Beauty and the Bike, is that a local documentary? It's certainly a community documentary.
So I was talking with Roxanne Debeau, who's the main person at the Camcycle group, and she was very keen to get involved. It's a film that she knows more than I do. I'm sort of like, I'm a cyclist, but I'm a bit on the periphery of the sort of politics of cycling in Cambridge. So I've just seen the trailer, so I've no idea what it's about other than what I've read. Two groups of teenage girls who are shown each other's lifestyles, and between them they explore their attitudes to cycling in many places around the world. So Amsterdam is a great example. The cycle infrastructure is so much more advanced than even here in Cambridge, which is the UK's number one cycling city. We have a long way to go to make cycling fair and equitable and easy for everybody. And I think this film really highlights some of the challenges that our planners really should be addressing in helping people to get on their bikes, and therefore, reduce reliance on cars. This film is about really holding back the car, holding it in check a little bit to give pedestrians and cyclists a little bit more of a space. And that benefits everybody in terms of air quality, quality of life, exercise, all of those things.
I'm aware that we're running tight on time, but what else are you particularly, not excited, that's such a reductive word, what else is screening that you think is particularly pertinent to now?
Oh, gosh, there's so many. So the two things that I really, I'm quite excited about, one is a very immersive film called Dance of Light. That's showing in the city centre. Forget the date. The details are all on the website, which we'll tell you about in a minute. Dance of Light is about how we connect with nature. And I know this sounds a bit airy-fairy, knit your own yogurt. I really do think that actually our concern, if we are concerned and we love something, we are automatically empowered to make changes and to do things for the support of those things that we love. So, you know, if you're looking for ways of trying to be in love with the planet in a very sort of visceral way, then this immersive film is something else really interesting. The other ones that I think are very pertinent, we've got an evening of short films on food waste. That's big news at the moment, particularly in the light of the big plastics and quests and packaging. Although more than that, there's, you know, what goes into our green bins can be reduced by eating or finding different ways of using food that's left over. One of the other ones I really like was...
There's a short film, what the waste, there's the Carnage, which is the veganism thing, but that's been on television, it's Simon Amstel's thing,
it
isn't
has,
it?
Yes. Yes, I think what's exciting about that is, but the film is really good, I have seen that on the BBC, but what's really exciting about that is that there's an opportunity to talk with real life vegans.
They're not like dinosaurs. We haven't reconstructed them out of DNA.
But also, you know, if you're just looking to make one small step as to make a difference, then cutting down your meat consumption is a good thing. And there may be people who are more advanced than they wanting to do something a bit bigger. So learning how to eat vegan is something I think we should all have a go with. I'm not saying we should all convert tomorrow, but let's all have a go at reducing our meat consumption, which will be good for the planet, and explore new and interesting ways of eating. And we've got some very talented vegans who are bringing along some snacks for people to try. So that should be a really good one to go for.
You've mentioned the website for more details.
It's www.filmsforourfuture.org.uk. You can also reach it via transitioncambridge.org. And there's full details of listings. Registration is required for some of the films, although all of them are free. We're very welcome to have... We would love some donations to help with our running costs, which are small but significant for small, fundless charities.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for coming in and talking. We'll have we'll give more bit details of the website at the end of the programme.
Thank you.
If you like books, writing, fiction, non-fiction, poetry, drama, and chat with authors from Cambridge and beyond, then save the page to bookmark every other Saturday at 1 p.m. with me, Lee Chambers, on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city.
Hello, it's Greg here. I'd like to tell you about the Kip of the Cat Show, where we play original 78 RPM gramophone records every other Tuesday night between 9 and 11 o'clock at night. And usually have one or two guests in with us as well. So come and join Kipper and me and enjoy the old music here on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city.
Still to come on today's Bums on Seats, we'll magnify the faults of Alexander Payne's downsizing and look behind the scenes of Aardman's Early Man. But before that, we head to the afterlife.
I know I'm not supposed to love music.
No music! No music!
But my great-grandma Coco's father was the greatest musician of all time.
Papa...
Ernesto de la Cruz.
One day, he left with his guitar and never returned.
No, my family thinks music is a curse.
Great-great-grandfather, none of them understand me.
I'm supposed to play music.
All right, who's in there?
I'm sorry. What's going on? I'm just dreaming.
Do you mind?
Welcome to the land of the dead.
Doctor, wait up!
You gotta stay with me, boy.
This isn't a dream, then. You're all really out there.
Agents at the Department of Family Reunions are available to assist you.
Please be on the lookout for a living boy.
Miguel? You're here.
We're your family, mijo.
Set during the Mexican Day of the Dead celebrations, Pixar Animation's Coco follows the adventures of 12-year-old Miguel. Miguel, a boy who dreams of growing up to be a musician, he spots his big chance in the town's talent competition. However, his family has long disavowed music, forcing him to break into the shrine of his hero, the late singer Ernesto de la Cruz, to steal his legendary guitar. This act magically pulls Miguel from the land of the living to the land of the dead, where there's a host of relatives who are shocked to see him. Emma, it's unusual for a family film to deal with the death and the afterlife. I can only really think of The Corpse Bride, actually. Does Coco manage to balance the subject, that subject matter, with its usual lightness, its buddy comedy sort of tone?
Yes. I mean, I wouldn't always say that Pixar has a buddy comedy kind of tone. I mean, you know, like we always, you know, everyone knows the first 4 minutes of Up or whatever. It's just one of the most tragic endings to a film ever. It does. It is, as you would expect from Pixar, gloriously detailed, amazing, you know, visually amazing, albeit, you know, now we've had Pixar in our lives for, what, nearly 30 years. Like, it was Toy Story 85, I think, so 32 years, is that right?
95.
22 years, Emma. 22 years. There are obviously, there are now similarities. There is a feel to Pixar films. Like, for example, I did feel in this when they reveal the world of the Day of the Dead, which is quite spectacular.
And, the you know, city the of the dead. That
yeah. There was a little bit of Inside Out was in there. And as I, you know, but it doesn't really matter because, like I say, Pixar do this so beautifully. And what a glorious tradition to tell, you know, to tell a story about. How gorgeous to think about all our generations and to have, you know, the lovely Coco, you know, the senile great-grandmother as such a key role in this. It's just a rather beautiful story, and it came with some unexpectedly glorious moments. It wasn't my favourite. I thought that the setup was a little clunky until he gets to the Day of the Dead. I wasn't necessarily that drawn into it, but once, once it whips away, it carries you with it.
Ashley, you said in the past that it's the duty of a children's film, certainly with this budget, to tell stories that don't fall back on cliche. You mentioned it with Paddington. This is a story about a Mexican boy. It uses Mexican actors. A lot of it's in. Certainly the signage and everything is in Mexican. Does that give the film an urgency and importance it may not have otherwise have had?
I think so. And maybe in a better way than the poster, I reckon, in some ways. It's only the second Pixar film to focus on a specific group of people after Brave was the Scottish. So now we have Mexican kids getting a day in the sun, which is very much needed. But the thing I liked a lot about it was it didn't look down on the young audience in the way that I think a lot of English and probably American films shy away from death and mortality. It's too much for their young audiences. But this is, you're immersed in it. And I thought that was really important and something really lacking in kids' cinema specifically.
Mark, does it play with the Pixar formula enough? Do you think they've got this wonderful idea of the living boy in the land of the dead and having to get his family's, this departed family's blessing in order to be able to move back to the land of the living? Does it stretch the formula enough? Because it Emma may mock me, but most of Pixar's films do fall onto this sort of sitcom-y back and forth between two characters. This does a little bit, but does it?
Yeah, I think it did. It felt, it's, as you say, it had the usual traits of a Pixar movie in how colourful and vibrant it was and the kind of the warmth of the film as a whole. But in terms of how it told the story, I thought it was quite different. And I find with a lot of films like that, I find myself sort of chuckling all the way through. There's humour sort of all the way through it. Whereas in this one, there is, but it's a more lightness of touch, I think, with this. It's not, you know, the relationship between Miguel and Hector, who's his main sort of companion to all this, is slightly different. It's a different kind of dynamic to me. At least it felt that way. And the way the story is told, I thought, was quite different as well. I think it is quite a clever sleight of hand in a way, when you think the story is maybe going to go one way and actually goes something
harder to follow
else.
Than most kids' films.
And it, yeah, you think you're going to have a fairly formulaic okay, this is going to happen, this is going to happen, and then it turns out to actually not really be the case. And that worked quite well for me. I like that, and I think it keeps you on your toes a bit, and I think certainly the kids will, yeah, who are watching it, will perhaps will be surprised, yeah, pleasantly surprised by how it unfolds.
I like the way, I noticed some of this whilst I was watching the film and realised, I think I made another connection this morning, in that it inverts the terrible American phrase of seize your moment, which is what Ernesto, the grand musician of the past, keeps saying, I seize my moment. And then we find out that he has murderous intents when he does that. So it inverts that message throughout the film. And then, but it is a mirror to that. It inverts the song, which is Remember Me, which is his grand romantic foolish gesture, and that gradually becomes smaller and smaller and smaller until it means much, much more. And those two changes mirror each other, which I thought was quite brilliant. I agree with you, Emma. I think it's so unusual, especially at the very beginning, which I found quite touching, to see a relationship, that sort of intergenerational relationship. And there's that wonderful, it's just a little bit where Miguel, when he's a young boy, when he says to his grandmother, who's too old at this stage to even respond, when he says, I used to run like this, but now I run like this. And that reminded me not of my childhood, but of my niece and the way she is of Mexican inheritance, heritage, her trying to talk to my grandmother, great-grandmother.
It reminded me of how my boys used to interact with James's grandmother when we would go and visit her when she was also extremely old and you know, memory was failing. And that's it. And I think Pixar do that thing incredibly well. They don't, like you say, they don't shy away from the bigger questions. And the idea in this that once you've died, then you're in the day of the dead, but of course you'll only stay in the day of the dead as long as there's someone.
There's three
on the
forms
other side
of death, and the third one is you're forgotten.
And there is this beautiful scene where Hector plays, you know, Remember Me for the first time to this older character who's kind of like a sort of, he's lying in a hammock just surrounded by all detritus he's picked up from the Day of the Dead. And I just realised it was voiced by Edward James Olmos, not that that's kind of relevant, this older character, as he drifts away from the Day of the Dead. And it was just almost unbearably touching. And there are lots, but also there are some brilliantly funny scenes, like when Ernesto de la Cruz, when he takes him to the party, when Miguel is like, I'm your great-great-grandson, I've come here for your blessing. And they have this fantastic scene, which is only about, I don't know, 50 seconds long, where it's just, he's showing him off around his party with all his friends. And it's just brilliant. I wish I could have just rewound it to watch that scene three or four times, because there was so much going on in it, and it was so funny.
I'm buying, when this comes out on Blu-ray, I'm buying it just to watch the scene with the triple deck. Triple-decker vehicular railway that goes up the castle. It is all shiny in sequence. It's quite, and the spirit animals. I had no idea that these Miyazaki-style spirit animals, these great lions and dogs and things, with all glistening like shiny pinatas. Yeah. It's just
amazing.
Yeah,
like kind of fluorescent black light or whatever. Like I say, the detail. And I noticed it's directed by, I think, quite a Pixar stalwart who did Toy Story 2 and 3. Lee
He co-directed it,
I think, too, and then he directed Toy Story 3, and he's co-written this and directed. So it's in a very safe pair of hands, and they've done another really top job for a family film.
I really liked how a lot of film, I mean, not so much Pixar films really, but kids films very often have a very kind of simple message at the end, and it's a very simple conclusion. I liked how this one doesn't really sort of come down too much on either side. It doesn't sort of ignore one. It emphasises the importance of family, and
it doesn't get too schmaltzy about it, I felt.
Take too much of it, and it also takes a dig at the superficiality of fame and so on, but it doesn't sort of go too far the other way.
It
sort of
feels like a story rather than a bundle of messages, quite on the we'll have to end on. Well, no, yeah, I think the fact that it doesn't feel like a group of messages is probably its strongest thing.
And not to mention the animation on the skeletons as well. It was just brilliant to have, you know, the characters of these non-flesh characters.
And the opening scene
it was. We have to wrap up.
Okay, well, Coco, which is fantastic, it opened last Friday and is still screening at both the View and Light cinemas in Cambridge. It is a certificate PG. That in itself is unusual, actually. It isn't the only extraordinary animated feature currently at the cinema. Released yesterday and showing across Cambridge's Early Man, the excellent new film from Bristol's brilliant Aardman Studios. Directed by Wallace and Gromit creator Nick Park, Early Man brings his stop-motion slapstick style to a tale that blends the exhilaration of a sports movie with the era of Stone Age Man. It's a beautifully detailed film, and to find out more about the time-consuming work that went into the production, I spoke to Merlin Crossingham, one of the two animation directors on the movie. Speaking from Aardman's Bristol studio, Merlin discussed the process of filming a complex feature-length stop-motion movie, but first he revealed what the job of animation director actually entails.
A rabbit! Get it!
That's it. That's it.
I've got him! For you, Emac!
Well, the job is making the movie on the studio floor. So it's very much Nick Park's movie. It's his idea. He drove the creative. He worked the film up. And he then asked me and my colleague, Will Beecher, to actually execute the film down on the studio floor. So composed the shots, directed the animators, worked with the art department to get it looking how Nick had in his mind. Essentially, we physically executed Nick's vision for him, which was no small task, I might add. It was a massive project.
When did you start work on Early Man and when did you finish? Because you were tweeting information on Early Man and studio shots quite recently.
Well, we wrapped on the studio floor first week of December. And we had been working on it since, well, testing started in early 2016. And the shoot sort of officially started later on in 2016. So, yeah, it was a good 18 months, really. What was it? At our maximum, we had 39 animators with about 42 shooting units in our huge stop-motion studio here in Bristol.
With Chicken Run and with Rare Rabbits, Nick Park's previous two features, they both sort of adopted a genre style, whether it was The Great Escape or the Hammer Horrors and that Rare Rabbit was mimicking. So I wondered if for Early Man there was a sort of a style book for designing shots, handling lighting, if there was something similar for that film.
Well, I suppose if it fits any genre, it's the sports movie, but not in a traditional sense.
I've heard about the game. Imagine if we lost.
Be warned!
I said imagine it! Exactly! The mighty Bronze Age, brought to its knees by a bunch of cavemen! Well, I'm warning you, Nuth, you'd better not lose!
End of message!
We did reference a lot of the early Ray Harryhausen, you know, 1 million years BC. We wanted quite a raw and rough, especially for the prologue at the beginning, we wanted it to have a sort of raw energy, which is actually very hard to do in stop-motion animation. Stop-motion is populated by control freaks, basically, and everybody wants, even though stop-motion by its nature is a bit lumpy and bumpy, everybody wants it to be slick and smooth and kind of perfect. And we had to work actually very hard to not lose that, but to park it to one side and make sure that it had a vibrancy and an energy and a sort of a rough and readiness, which is maybe to the outside world isn't apparent that it's quite hard to get that.
Well, I wonder if you could run through the process between script draft to animation, how collaborative it is, how many layers of storyboarding, how much it relies on group feedback, like the Pixar model in a way, though they didn't originate it, in order to make sure that there isn't a single wasted second.
No, or frame even. So what happens is, like any project, the script gets worked and worked and worked. And when the script is ready for storyboarding, that's really where the visual humor starts to evolve and to bubble up. The story artists are all chosen for their not only great ability for visual storytelling, but for their comic chops as well. So if there's an opportunity to add a joke, they will pitch it in. It's really important that everybody at every level feels that they can at least contribute. And our team at Aardman isn't massive. You know, we're a large studio, but with comparison to places like Disney, Pixar and the like, our teams are relatively small. And so things like visual humour in the background, a lot of the posters, a lot of the things like the zebra crossing being a flat zebra and things like that, a lot of that comes from the art department. Our art department is also littered with very talented comic people, and they spend, you know, they spend a lot of time having fun coming up with these ideas. And that's really important, that if you give people the chance to feel creatively invested, that they have fun doing it. And I really think it comes out on the screen.
So how do you work on a particular sequence? Is it you overseeing an animator? Are they assigned sequences as well? So there's a little core team per sequence?
Yes, absolutely. Our lead animators get assigned, or cast, I think is a better word for it, because we treat our animators like actors. They are the people putting the performance on the screen, just not with their bodies. They're doing it via our puppets. So our animators are cast to sequences, and that gives us continuity of performance through the sequence. So, for example, in our film, there's a character which is a message bird, voiced by Rob Brydon.
Ah, delivering message?
Your footballness, it's a message bird.
One of our animators, Rodri, he worked on it for 9.5 months, yet it's only a couple of minute sequence in the movie, but he was the person who developed the physicality of the puppet in a kind of rehearsing in the development stages of the movie. And then he took those sequences and continued to animate them. And without that continuity, I think the character would have been much weaker.
Hello? Hello? How do you use this message bird thing?
It's the queen.
Just speak into its ear, ma'am. It will mimic everything it hears.
It's interesting that you still, within reason, allow the thumminess of the animator's presence to be felt. Everybody goes on about the flashing or the boiling that you can see on King Kong's fur from Willis O'Brien. Of course, Willis O'Brien would have been furious about that.
Oh, he was. Yeah, but anecdotally, he was. And I was lucky enough to work with Ray Harryhausen, and he constantly went on about it when we were talking about his work on those movies. And actually, on Early Man, a lot of the cavemen have fur tunics. And it was a conscious decision for us not to try and eradicate that. So when you watch the movie, you will see, well, you won't, because you don't notice it, because it feels like part of their world. But if you're conscious of it, you may notice the odd twitch and boil. And we actually embraced that. When we made Chicken Run, it being our first feature film, we were very conscious of the fingerprints and the texture. And we spent a long time trying to eradicate it. So if you look at Chicken Run, they're very, very smooth. And that was partly because the chickens' bodies were made of silicone, which was smooth. And so the modeling clay didn't look like a continuation of their bodies from body to neck, which was a transition from silicone to modeling clay. And afterwards, I mean, I'm very proud of Chicken Run, but there was kind of something missing. And so then when Nick Park and Steve Box came to make Were-Rabbit, we made a conscious decision to brief the animation team to keep it thummy and funny. And that was the sort of the watchwords, thummy and funny. And since then, we've really embraced it. And Early Man just continues that. And I think there's something very human about the physical actual contact that you don't necessarily notice, but you just understand that it's real and that someone's touched it and it's been made. And I don't want people to be thinking of that when they watch the movie. I want people to be lost in the movie. But just subconsciously, I think there's something about stop motion that makes it interesting and appealing, is that human touch.
You've mentioned everything that an animation director has to do, and the vast amount you have to keep your eye on. Are you now like the desk sergeant in an American police station, that you don't get to go on the beat any longer? Do you get to do any animation yourself now?
What was the last thing I animated? I animated a little bit of Morph about 3 years ago, and that's kind of fun. I also do the voice of Morph, by the way. But no, there's just no time. I mean, when Will and I were directing the animation on Early Man, we had usually about 20 units to get around every day, and our ADs had pretty much every minute of every day accounted for. And you would finish briefing or setting up on one unit, and as you're walking to the next one, the AD is briefing me on what I'm going to be seeing on the next unit, while at the same time on the radio kind of talking to the floor manager to get the crew there so that our time isn't wasted. And you know, it's just a massive, massive juggling act to get it moving smoothly. And then after that, we might go up to the viewing theatre to view a shot that's just come in, or do some approvals in edit, and then we might go to model making to check a prop that's coming in for a future shot. Yeah, and we're just having to jump from one thing to another thing to another thing, from the front end of the movie to the back end of the movie. So you have to have the whole film in your head as well. And all I can say is that the crew we have at Aardman is second to none. They are brilliant craftspeople who are at the top of their game. And without a crew like that, we couldn't make movies like Early Man. So it's an absolute pleasure to work with them.
Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Many, many thanks to Merlin for the interview and to Anna Lewis at Aardman Animations for helping to arrange it. A longer cut of that interview will be included in our podcast. We spoke about a lot of things, from storyboarding to how you test screen stop motion animation. Early Man was released yesterday. It's dependably terrific and is now showing at both Cambridge Multiplex cinemas and is set to open at the Arts Picture House next Friday.
Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 Radio.
We wrap up today's show with Downsizing, the latest film from writer-director Alexander Payne. Matt Damon and Kristen Wiig star as Paul and Audrey Zofranek. Suburban Americans just getting by, even on two paychecks. To obtain some measure of financial security, they make the big decision to opt for downsizing, a crazy scientific procedure that shrinks a human down to only 5 inches tall. This reduction in height means that their meager savings suddenly seem a fortune, and it introduces them to a new world where you can live the American dream at a Lilliputian scale.
I know this can put a pretty big dent in anyone's self-esteem. But downsizing is about hitting the reset button. Start all over.
I have allergies. Wait. I'm going to take off my shoes.
You may find yourself.
Open your eyes.
In another part of the world.
The world is filled with things to see.
And you may say to yourself, my God, what have I done? Letting
the days go. That woman is really sick.
You help her.
These are the people that we should be helping.
Something very big is happening. Something top secret.
Same as it ever was.
Why did I downsize?
Same as
so that I could be here, right now. I finally have a chance to do something that matters.
You think we're in the normal world, and then something happens.
Oh my God.
And you realize we're not.
Same as it ever was.
Ashley, the trailer paints this downsizing as a sort of cute, sort of science fiction-y comedy, but it's not really that. I'm not sure it's entirely successful, but it is more sort of a sort of sad sack American middle-aged tale.
I think my main problem with the film is how it was sold, and I think they realised in post that this wasn't good in the sense of what they were aiming for, so they tried to sell it as something different, and it's really benefited from overblown press saying best film of the year. I think the quote I keep seeing is downsizing is perfect. So I went in with very high expectations, which is never good for me anyway, because I'm quite easily let down. I came into this thinking, what's going on? I understand. I think the core idea of what they were trying to say, and this might be overselling the writing here, is that it doesn't matter. There's undertones of the environment and the economy, which are just lightly touched on. It's very superficial, but I think the key message they were trying to get at is it doesn't matter what you try and seek redemption in or change in your life if you're not in the right place on your own. So Matt Damon gets downsized, his life doesn't get any better, he tries this, he tries that, he goes to the party and takes some stuff, still doesn't have a good time,
because he's aiming too high, he keeps thinking he's something special because he's been sold this American dream, and he is not special. He's not a terrible person. He's a well-meaning ordinary person who can do one thing, sort of slight doctory skill well. But even at the beginning, he thinks, why did I meet therapist. You if I'm not going to become this? Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I think he really believes his own hype and just falls for it totally.
But the film is aware of that up until the very end. And even at the end, there's no, he's not.
I didn't believe in his relationship with his wife, and I don't think you were supposed to, and you'll see that quite early on. I didn't believe in his relationship with the other female lead.
The Vietnamese lady
who does have a very exciting backstory, but then is sort of dragged down to earth. I didn't. Christoph Waltz sort of playing the caricature of a character that he's given, and there were so many things they tried to do, and it was so, it's like a teacher, I think, marking an essay, whereas they know the answer, but you just haven't written it down correctly. Just, it's there and you just haven't executed it.
Mark, first and foremost, this is a science fiction premise. Does it at least explore that premise? Because I was quite impressed how it kept coming up with new things to do with miniaturization and new ideas.
I liked how they made it all seem quite normal after they discovered the process. And then we advanced, 5 years from when they discovered the process, then was it another 10? And I kind of liked how that went from being, this grand, amazing discovery, and you kind of get how that excites everybody. Mm. And then
it's as big as a smartphone being invented, basically. Wasn't
it? And then when you forward on the years, everything is just so normal, and it's just, I like how people just refer to going small as being miniaturised. It just becomes a matter of conversation. It's like you might just be talking about, I don't know, maybe emigrating or something, or going abroad or something. And it's I kind of liked how they did that, and the little touches as well with the keepsake box. I thought was quite clever.
Moving personal items from large life to miniaturisation.
And how that then, once he's miniaturised, when you see that reappear, the little touches like that I thought were good. I quite enjoyed that. But then that's all in the first part of the movie. And of course,
it's worth pointing out this film changes tone several times,
it's in the second.
I'm in two minds about this film, because obviously all I read was terrible, terrible reviews. I saw nobody say it was perfect. Mm. And it's suffered from Matt Damon being a bit of a doofus in press, because he'll answer any question you give him. Mm. And he'll give you a nice headline-friendly answer.
He'll read whatever is on the auto cue.
I think he's a well-meaning man who speaks before he thinks most of the time.
Like
his character, which is why he plays it so well. But I thought, in the end, I thought this was a more interesting idea of a dystopian future than Blade Runner, because it actually looks at a great big discovery. Matt Damon says this is the biggest thing since the moon landing, and how quickly it becomes humdrum, as you mentioned, Mark, but how quickly it's spoiled by everybody. And it looks like everybody's doing this, and everybody's downsizing, and then you find out later on somebody says 5% of humanity's done this. And that's just typical. That's what would happen. Mm. And I thought it took the idea that how immigration, how political prisoners, how this miniaturization is used by dictators and by governments, I thought was more interesting. Mm. It felt like a dystopian future where they'd spent more time on characters than designing what everybody would wear and the guns everybody would shoot. It felt more genuinely interested in
I'll
the possibilities.
Go for that. Yeah, but it cannot redeem itself with the amount of brilliant ideas that were just right there. And then they changed scene, changed idea, changed from talking about the economy to the environment, and really not explaining that.
I think you're giving. I'm defending a film I think is really sloppy, but the environmental thing, which is mentioned twice, the idea the permafrost is melted and released. even that, where you're given the sense that the apocalypse is just coming, and you find out Christoph Waltz's character says, we've still got 200, 300 years left, which is terrible, but it shows how perspectives change. If the world's going to end in 300 years' time, it's not really going to end. I think it plays on a lot of really nice, clever ideas and deals with them, but it seems, outside the sloppiness of it, I think it just feels unfashionable. One, it's got a sort of the main character being this white American who suffered from the economy moving elsewhere, who's of course a certain type of white American who voted for Trump because he promised he'd solve that. So I think that's made it slightly unfashionable, which I think is unfair on the film. I think the Vietnamese character is portrayed interestingly. Matt Damon's character doesn't have a redemption arc. He doesn't get what he gets slightly
he's
wiser.
He's the stupid guy. He's the Vietnamese lady is the straight guy, and she turns it. She's
Hong Chau, I should point out, playing the dissident.
She's given a lot of really sort of spicy lines. The way she delivers them, she ends up looking stupid, but you just read under it for just half a second. You realise that she's the intelligent one next to Matt Damon.
But again, I think that's just misreading the film. Reading interviews with Alexandra Payne and why this Vietnamese character might be, which has been read as racist, because obviously we're now looking for ways to read headlines in the stories. And he said, well, actually, she's supposed to be talking in the way that somebody
she's
who's learned
to make Matt Damon understand her because he is dumb.
But it's because she hasn't been, she's learned a language secondhand. She hasn't been schooled in it. And they went carefully thought about how that would sound.
Yeah. Adopting his ears, colloquialisms, sounds, trying to make herself heard. But yet there are so many brilliant, just they almost tip into talking about really heavy stuff in a cute, non-cynical, non-overly sexy Blade Runner way. And they could have done it really well. And they failed every
but then
5 minutes.
I'm so willing to give somebody the benefit of the doubt if at least they tried. I felt this film kept trying
at least Blade
to do
Blade Runner looked good.
I think it's a far more interesting film than the trailer makes it. I mean, the trailer makes it look like a completely different film, I agree, but it's much more interesting
like
than
film,
the film that you maybe thought you were going to see from the trailer. I think actually
if they took themselves a little more seriously,
I have to say,
they would have done really
like,
well.
Like Toby, I'd read some quite negative things about it going into the film, so my expectations were slightly different anyway. And I think that my view would have been probably quite different had I not and just gone in having seen the trailer. But I liked some of the things it was exploring and what it was getting into.
They didn't get it. It's crashing down the Metacritic store. Day by day by day.
Oh, I don't care about that. That doesn't matter. I wish it was a faster film.
Go see Coco. That was better.
Yes. In fairness, it's not dealing with the same themes. Okay, well, all right. Well, Downsizing opened yesterday, Friday the 26th, and is now showing at the Arts Picture House, and I think it's at Light. There are a few screenings because it's got such terrible reviews, which I think is a bit sad. Anyway, so Certificate 15. And that's all we've time for on this edition of Bums on Seats. If you missed anything, our repeat is now Sunday afternoon, tomorrow at 2 p.m. Plus, as always, our podcast, which will include much more of an interview with Merlin Crossingham on Early Man, and which may be found and downloaded from our page on the Cambridge 105 website or from our page on iTunes. And don't forget, you can subscribe to the show on iTunes and you can leave us a review. We'll be back in a fortnight's time, February the 10th, with an all-new edition. That show should include a review of Phantom Thread, Paul Thomas Anderson's kinky, rich, and strange drama about obsessiveness in all things. Plus, we may have a preview of the next Real Women event in February, and we will have a preview of this year's Watersprite International Student Film Festival. Quick bit of listings of upcoming film events. We're playing out with some Natasha Atlas to highlight that in a fortnight's time, there will be the return of the Ebab Festival at the Cambridge Junction. The Festival of Culture from the Middle East takes place on Friday and Saturday, the 9th and 10th of February. There's lots of music, not just Natasha Atlas, but also the Arabic and Iraqi folk of Sawa. And there's also cinema at 4:30 on the Saturday. There is a chance to see In Between, a lively and wonderfully lived-in drama about three women from different backgrounds finding common ground in Tel Aviv. More details from the Cambridge Junction site, which is www.junction.co.uk. Also, the wonderful community cinema of Screen St. Ives is marking Holocaust Memorial Day with a special showing of The Excellent Son of Saul. The screening, which will be followed by a Q&A with a fellow from the Imperial War Museum in Holocaust Education, is at 8 p.m. on Thursday the 1st of February. Tickets are only £5. More information may be found on www.screensaintives.org.uk. But that's it for this programme. From everybody here on Bums on Seats, goodbye.
Bye. Bye.